It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And in the first part of the show, Chris, I'm getting a little punny here, but this is going to be an utterly amazing show today.
Okay.
We are going to talk a lot about otters today.
Otters.
Yeah, but first, first guests are Kate Ireland, who's the Director of Youth Engagement for the Nature Conservancy, and she leads a team that is elevating the voices of young leaders through innovative programs and curricular resources. And she has one of her externs here. So they do these externships with the National Geographic Society. And actually, no. But Marie Taylor, who is one of the externs, studied California sea otters. And we're going to hear about her studies and what her externship was like with this program. It sounds absolutely fantastic.
All right. That's all in the first part of the show.
Yes.
And the second, we'll keep with the otter theme.
Yes.
And kind of play an encore performance, an interview you and I had with Ryan Langendorf back a few months ago. He's a professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and he's also with the Doak Lab. And he's going to share with us a recent study that he performed, shedding light on sea otters as a keystone species helping to regenerate kelp forests.
Yes.
Perfect.
It's all tied in together today.
Can't talk enough about otters. Environmental awareness and education, that's what this Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And our first guest today, we have Kate Ireland, who is the Director of Youth Engagement for the Nature Conservancy. She leads a team that is elevating the voices of young leaders through innovative programs and curricular resources. And one of those programs are externships. And joining us is an extern who is Marie Taylor, who did studies on the California sea otters. Welcome to This Green Earth.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, we are excited to talk to you. We obviously have an affinity for otters here on This Green Earth and everything that they do for our environment. So I'd like to dive into that. But Kate, first, I really want to talk to you about these programs and let you lay the groundwork and give us the landscape of this relationship with the National Geographic Society. And you do this program with the Nature Conservancy. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're really excited at the Nature Conservancy to think deeply about how we are investing in young people today and preparing them for tomorrow. And so the externship that we're running together with National Geographic Society is one of those flagship programs. We also offer free K-12 content, which through our Nature Lab content, we have a really great virtual field trip that will take folks to the Great Salt Lake that we released this fall. We have really exciting programs happening on the ground with young people. We actually run over 200 youth programs globally. There's two phenomenal examples locally in Utah, Wings in Water, that's working with almost 30,000 young people, bringing them on preserves, teaching them about wetlands each year, the Nature Internship that is working together with Indigenous students locally to explore different conservation careers through traditional ecological knowledge alongside tools like GIS. And then there's our externship program, which is happening at a global level. And we are, together with National Geographic Society, bringing together cohorts of 100 young people for 8 weeks at a time to really dig into a particular conservation topic. They're learning from an online platform. They are partnered up with expert mentors from both TNC and National Geographic Society. They're attending weekly speaker series, and then they're doing their own research in their communities, really investigating a conservation issue that feels significant, important to them, identifying solutions, and then can look to apply for seed funding to implement some of those ideas. So we've been thrilled to be offering this since 2021. We have 1,300 alum of the program, and Marie is one of those phenomenal alumni who have just really done tremendous things and are incredibly inspiring.
So, Kate, you said you have 1,300 alumni?
We do, yeah. And we just keep growing the program. We are offering, we are now offering the externship to 400 young people each year. We hope to continue to grow the program, but we have just seen such tremendous demand for it and interest. We really want to answer the call that we're hearing from young people.
How do students apply, or, you know, how do you find your externs?
Yeah, so we have an application process 3 times a year. We actually are just finishing up applications for our summer cohort. If you go onto nature.org or to the National Geographic Society page, just search for externship in the search bar. It'll take you right to our page with an application link. It's a really quick application process. We move folks through from there and then we'll kick off in just a few weeks with our next summer cohort. Hmm.
So when you started this partnership, did you think it was going to grow this exponentially and that you were going to get this much of a response? Because it seems wonderful that there's that many students out there and young people that want to do this line of work.
I would have never anticipated this level of interest. We absolutely know from our experiences at the Nature Conservancy, from the interest we see, that there is desire and demand for leadership opportunities, for content, things that will help young people be leaders within their communities as it relates to nature. I couldn't have anticipated this demand, and I think my colleagues at National Geographic Society would say the same. We have now, for those 1,300 spots, we have received over 72,000 applications. We just are overwhelmed by the demand, the interest in the program, which is why we are continuing to grow it, and also look at different ways we can be supporting young people in their leadership journeys and as conservation leaders in their communities.
And these topics are wide-ranging as well, and they're all dealing with things to do with nature and our environment, but they are global. And some of these students are tackling some of the biggest issues that we're facing.
That's absolutely right. It is a very global program. You know, while we have a specific topic area, we may focus on freshwater for one cohort, marine conservation for another. We've done a data visualization piece. Each individual extern is really reflective of their community. And within a cohort of 100, we may have 75 different countries represented. We may have 20 different U.S. states represented. And so there are so many different geographies, issues, local passions that are represented when you look across the span of those 8 weeks, and then multiply that by the 4 cohorts we're offering each year.
Speaking of programs, I think there were 2 ongoing in Utah. One was like Wings Over Water or so.
Yeah, Wings in Water. Wings that in is water. A now 19-year-long program that is headed up by the TNC chapter within Utah. They're bringing 27,000 young people ages K-12 out to the Great Salt Lake Shorelands Preserve, which is a Nature Conservancy preserve locally. And the young people are engaging in wetlands exploration. There's content that goes alongside that. It's really focused on how to bring science learning to life through this hands-on outdoor discovery. And then we also, within Utah, there is the Nature Internship, which they've just onboarded. I think their newest cohort, they'll have 8 students from 6 different tribes as a part of this summer's cohort. I believe it actually just kicked off yesterday on the 16th. And that is really focused on how to support young people exploring conservation careers, how they can integrate traditional ecological knowledge, how they can work alongside restoration science using that knowledge, and then giving them an opportunity to present that content to the TNC staff and folks that they're working alongside.
Well, it seems like such a phenomenal program, and we are really pleased today that we get to speak with an extern, Marie Taylor. Hello, Marie.
Hi.
We are so glad to have you with us here, and your topic that you did was about Southern California sea otters. So tell us a little bit about yourself and why sea otters. Why did you delve into this topic?
I'm Marie. I'm a zoology student at Utah Valley University right now. When I started the externship, it was a marine conservation externship, you know, and I am, of course, from landlocked Utah, where we don't have the ocean. So I was trying really hard to think about what topic, and I have just absolutely always loved sea otters. I love otters of all kinds. I also love river otters and just small cod otters and otters, but I've always really, really loved sea otters. And I was like, when am I going to when am I going to have another chance to get to work with sea otters, you know? And then as I did more digging, it became a lot more meaningful than just loving sea otters, because a lot of people don't know that it's really, really crucial for sea otters to conserve their energy. They have to eat around 25% of their body weight each day to have enough energy to be healthy and stay warm, because they don't have blubber like other marine mammals. So they have to eat and groom and rest a lot to just maintain themselves. So when humans go up to them and try to pet them or just take selfies with them, they can really scare them and cause them to dive and swim off. And this uses a lot of energy that they need just to survive. So it became really important for me to spread that message and let others know that.
And what were some of your discoveries about sea otters that you found to be the most fascinating?
Oh, sea otters have the densest fur of any animal ever. They have about 1 million furs per square inch, I think, which is really cool. And then also, this one is really important for the planet. Sea otters are, I think you already mentioned this, keystone species.
Right.
They eat sea urchins, which would otherwise decimate kelp forests, which is really important because kelp forests store insane amounts of carbon, which is really important for climate change. So sea otters are indirectly climate change heroes.
So 25% of their body weight, what is the typical weight of a sea otter?
I think sea otters, they weigh quite a bit. They're like, because they're part of the weasel family.
Yeah.
And they are the biggest member of the weasel family. Females weigh around 50 pounds and males weigh around 70 pounds.
Wow. So they're taking in, they got to take in somewhere between 15 and maybe even 20 pounds a day. What does their diet consist of? You mentioned sea urchins, other things?
Yeah, they also eat just many like small marine animals. Like I know they eat crabs. They eat lots of just small urchins, crabs, clams, mussels, anything like that.
And I'm sure they have plenty of natural predators, but it sounds like the humans are their biggest threat. So what are some of the outlined things that you put together to help us be a little bit more cognizant about how we are around sea otters?
Yeah, so everyone should stay about 60 feet away. And instead of trying to take selfies, you should take photos from afar. And if you want to see them really well, I always highly recommend getting binoculars, because then you're still able to experience them and see their faces really well, but without going up and hurting them. And if you're going to kayak or boat near them, don't go at them directly because that will scare them. Just pass them parallel. Don't circle them. Don't do anything that could come off as predatory. And always spread the word and tell others, because many people hurt sea otters just without knowing. They go up to them and they want to take a selfie and they don't think about the harm that it can cause. And so spreading that word and awareness is really, really important. And always donating to organizations like Sea Otter Savvy and the Wildlife Conservation Network has a sea otter fund. And so doing any of those things can really help sea otters.
Do otters live in like families or packs, or what is their social skills like?
Yeah. So sea otters are pretty social. They have groups called rafts, which I think is a very fun name.
Yes.
And then mothers, when they have their pups, they will have their pups stay with them for a really long time, unlike some other animals. Sea otter moms are really, really engaged. They help groom their pups for months and help feed them and do all that for a really long time. But yeah, they do spend time in rafts. A lot of times, actually, if you go to California or Alaska or places with a lot of sea otters, you can see the rafts, which is really fun.
So what has the decline been like for sea otters? Are we seeing large amounts of decline for these animals?
Well, so they were actually almost hunted to extinction in like the 19th century. It wasn't until the Marine Mammal Protection Act that they, in 1972, that they finally started coming back. They were almost completely extinct at that time, which is really sad because people would hunt them for their fur because it's the densest fur of any animal. So they have been rising since then, but they are still endangered. So there's still a lot of work to be done.
So you said that you are in Utah. So you're studying, am I correct in saying zoology at Utah Valley University?
Yeah, I am. I have about 2 more years to go. But UVU has been really awesome. I also actually study bottlenose dolphins with a professor at UVU.
Wow. Well, eventually, I hope you're going to get to the coast. To actually,
I know. I want to.
You mentioned that they have a broad diet. And that's what makes them, I guess, really important to ecosystems. Because in their absence, we might have increasing populations of, say, sea urchins, and sea urchins can do a lot of damage to kelp forests. Is that right?
Yeah. They have sea urchin barrens when sea urchins eat too much, where the kelp forests are just completely gone. And kelp forests are an important ecosystem for many, many species. And like I said, they also help store carbon, which helps with climate change. So it has really dire consequences.
So when you're looking towards your future, Marie, what is it that you would like to do with this knowledge and with your degree? What is it that you're most looking forward to?
Well, with specifically sea otters and this project, I really want to spread the word as much as I can. I've been focusing on California, but I would love to focus on more states. 90% of the world's sea otters actually live in Alaska, and there's a big tourism industry there, so I would love to help spread the word there too. And then just in general in my career, after my bachelor's, I hope to pursue a master's degree and eventually become a wildlife biologist and just help conserve and protect animals as much as I can.
Well, you're focused on sea otters, but there are also freshwater otters in some parts of the world. Are there otters here in the Utah or in the Mountain West?
There are river otters in Utah. They're kind of hard to find. They're pretty rare. I know the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium has a project with otters, actually, river otters. But you can find them in Utah.
Oh, like you say, though, it's not easy. Maybe somewhere along the Provo or Green or some larger water bodies of water.
Yeah, I know they've been spotted around the Provo otter. They have had a lot of decline in their population due to habitat loss and trapping and lots of bad human things, which is sad. But they are around the Provo River.
You also received some seed funding at the end of this externship to continue your work. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. I think they had 15 people receive funding, so I was super, super excited to receive that. And with that, I created an Instagram and a Facebook. It's how_to_help_the_sea_otter, if anyone wants to follow that. But I was able to promote those social media accounts to help spread the word internationally as much as I can. And then I also did a table at an event called Whale Fest in Monterey, California, because Monterey has many, many sea otters. And that's a huge event that gets many people a year. And so I had a table there where I talk to people and let them know like how they can help, because that's the community that's near the sea otters and who the sea otters are really affecting. So it was really awesome to be able to talk to all the locals there and let them know how they can help and make an impact. And those have been my main projects. I also actually went on the news in Utah to help try to spread the word. So I've just been really trying to spread awareness and get the word out there as much as I can so people can be educated and know to respect sea otters and also all wildlife.
And I just wanted to add, you mentioned Monterey Bay Aquarium. Monterey Bay Aquarium has a otter cam. So you can go on anytime, YouTube or so, and live stream their otter cam. And honestly, I'm not making this up. If I'm stressed out or something, I will turn on the otter cam and I can watch otters just swim around and float about on their backs for a really concerning amount of time.
Well, I think that's great, because I think to Marie's point about protecting them, maybe that's the best way to protect them. If you want to see them, go on there and check out their behaviors, because obviously they are adorable.
Sure.
They are an adorable species of animal, and it is understandable that people are get a little bit enthused about watching them, or it might be, in Chris's case, soothing. For a long day, it's very therapeutic to watch the otters enjoying life. Well, Marie, you're the brightest of our stars coming through Utah, and we appreciate you doing this work and being part of this. Now, Kate, when you hear Marie talk and her excitement and her enthusiasm, how does that feel, and does it help fuel your fire to just keep these programs going and expanding them?
Always, always. It's so incredible. Every day I think I hear from one of our one of the young people we work with, and it just astounds me. I was not this engaged and on fire when I was in my early 20s and when I was 18 to 25. And it's just really phenomenal to see how knowledgeable this generation is, how action-oriented they are. And I'm just thrilled to be able to stand alongside them together with the Nature Conservancy so that we can really be supportive of their work.
Nice. And I can only imagine with that many people that have gone through the program at this point that they really are making a difference and that they are coming up with creative solutions, because a lot of the times we can point out what these problems are and these issues, but it's hard to find solutions. And I'm loving the fact that these young minds are going out there with these fresh perspectives and probably helping us find better solutions.
That's exactly right. I think a lot of times the conversation is around how we're preparing the next generation of conservationists, how we are providing the tools that they need, and that's absolutely an important piece of it. I have a four-year-old, that's the work that we're doing with her at home, but there is so much that is happening right now. There are so many young people, Marie and others, that have solutions today for issues today, that have advocacy tools, that have big ideas. And we know that if we really stand a chance of achieving the goals we want to achieve as it relates to climate change, as it relates to nature loss, we need to be thinking about how we're working together now and today, not just in the future. And so that's really what we're trying to do with programs like the externship, like the nature internship, really think about how we can be together shoulder to shoulder in this moment.
And one more time, how people can go on to look at these programs and get involved.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you hop onto nature.org and just search, you can see in the top bar, you'll be able to explore resources and you can explore education resources there. That'll take you there. But if you just type in externship at the top search, you'll also get there. So hop on over to nature.org. We have a lot of wonderful things to offer. But if you want to specifically see more about the externship, you can search there.
Well, the Nature Conservancy has been such a wonderful organization globally, but for us, especially also here in Utah, you guys have made a big impact. So we are thrilled to have had you here on our show, This Green Earth. It's Kate Ireland, Director of Youth Engagement for the Nature Conservancy, who's leading this team on elevating the voices of young leaders and doing this through programs like externships and partnerships with the National Geographic Society. And we also had Marie Taylor, who is one of the externs. And thank you so much, Marie, for telling us your knowledge about sea otters. And we are looking forward to hearing what you're doing in the future.
Right. Thanks, Marie.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Excellent. Well, we'll have you all back because I think there's so much going on there at the Nature Conservancy that we would love to talk to you again. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
And joining us now is Ryan Elman Langendorf. Ryan is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and works with the DOAC Lab. So, Ryan, let's have you share a little background on yourself, what you do at the university and your studies and what's happening with the DOAC Lab.
Yeah, well, first, it's just great to be with both of you. Thanks for having me on. I'm an ecologist by training, and the DOAC Lab, they're quantitative ecologists at the University of Colorado, which is where I did my PhD. That's how I met Dan. And then somewhere during my PhD, I sort of morphed from a field biologist into more of a computational mathematical modeler kind of ecologist. And that was a huge part of what led me into this research on kelp forests, trying to just understand how these ecosystems function.
So one of the studies you've recently penned has to do with sea otters and the role they play in helping to stabilize kelp forests, which are imperative for not only animals that directly inhabit those areas, but also for all of us. So in this study, you identify sea otters as keystone species. So first, why don't we define what a keystone species is, and then give us some solid characteristics and basically attributes of the sea otter. Let's break down these creatures.
Yeah, well, the idea of a keystone species, it's a metaphor for an arch, and that last stone that you drop in at the very top of the arch as you're building it, the rest of the stones kind of push up against it, and that one at the center at the top, it sort of holds all the weight and keeps the whole thing from falling apart. And ecologists love this metaphor because some species are just disproportionately important to their ecosystem, and if they weren't there, the whole arch, the system would fall apart. So that's where the idea of a keystone species comes from. And yeah, sea otters are one of these. They They love eating urchins, among other things. They're a predator, and they're pretty adorable in how they do this. They catch urchins, and they love to come up to the surface and float on their back and eat their meal, and they'll hold hands with each other and form these large floating rafts. But while they're snacking on urchins, they're performing this really important service for the ecosystem, which is to keep the urchins from overgrazing all the kelp and just sort of slowly destroying the entire underwater forest. And so by doing this, they allow the entire system to kind of reach a different kind of balance where lots of different species can coexist. It's not to say that there's no change going on, but they prevent the system from falling apart and turning into what's called an urchin baron, which is all these little zombie urchins that are wandering around looking for more kelp, but they've just eaten up all the kelp and all the fish and other species leave, and the system really falls apart. And so because their presence keeps the kelp forest alive, they're considered a keystone species.
Yeah, that's super interesting, because the sea urchins, while they have their purpose, they are rapidly moving through these kelp forests and degrading them. And so can you describe for us that ecosystem and kind of what's living there peacefully, and then what the sea urchin's role is? Does it have a role in that ecosystem that's positive? And then also why they need to be kept in check and why there needs to be a sea otter around to do so?
You know, that's a great question. They're always painted as the villain of the story. I mean, I think that without sea urchins at all, they also help to sort of like allow some amount of disturbance to the kelp, allows more kelp species to live there. There's all kinds of other things. There's snails, there's abalone, there are sea stars. There's some really big sea stars that are also predators in this system. These giant sunflower stars, there are cucumbers. There's all kinds of things living here. But what happens is the urchins, they just have an insatiable appetite. And there's a couple different urchin species. The big ones are red and purple urchins. And if they're left unchecked, they'll just eat up everything to the point where all these other species just don't have the infrastructure of the forest. They really do look like underwater forests. And if all the plants are eaten up, then there's no shelter, there's no place to hide from predators, there's nothing else for other species to eat, and the system kind of falls apart.
Yeah, the sea urchins are also in the cycle here because they are a food source to these stars.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah, if they weren't there being a food source for sea otters, then it would be harder for sea otters to exist there. And they do all sort of need each other to keep this system alive. But some species, if left unchecked, would just sort of slowly destroy it, not intentionally, in the same way that I don't think it's like the sea otters they're not trying to build a kelp forest, but through their actions, they're able to suppress the urchins enough so that the urchins, who are not trying to destroy their home either, they don't want the kelp forest to disappear, but they just lose sight of what they're doing and they eat up all the kelp.
So Ryan, prior to man showing up, these kelp forests were ecosystems were, well, we'll call them fairly balanced in nature, I guess you can say that there were all types of species, lots of diversity, and the otters were at the, as you say, a keystone species of this ecosystem. And then man shows up and starts harvesting and killing otters by, you know, hundreds or thousands, and damaging these ecosystems to the point where kelp forests that were completely absent of otters?
Yeah, you know, I don't know the really ancient history, but the first humans in North America, which some people call these people the Clovis people, we have archaeological evidence of human beings that crossed over and were found. There's evidence in like New Mexico, Arizona. And we've always thought that they only could have been there post the glaciers retreating. And more recently, there's this evidence that's called the kelp forest hypothesis, or the kelp forest highway hypothesis, that people first crossed over the land bridge and then started to come down before the glaciers retreated by following the coast along the Pacific Ocean. And they subsisted off of kelp forests and the food that they were able to find and the sort of the resources from these kelp forests that were already there along the Pacific coast. So they're very ancient, and they're a part of our history and how we first arrived as Homo sapiens in North America. And otters have been a big part of maintaining those kelp forests for a really long time. You're right then that more recently, in more modern history, the fur trade really decimated sea otters, and we kind of hunted them to the point of local extinction, extirpation. And this story is really about when otters are brought back, how they reform the kelp forests that had been there for so long but had been lost because we had hunted otters for their fur. And now that isn't happening in the same way. And we've slowly allowed, by helping and also on their own, otters have come back. And these kelp forests have regrown in many places. And this study was trying to understand, how do they regrow? Why do they regrow differently in different places? What is, you know, what's the right way to reintroduce species more generally, not just into kelp forests? So very ancient systems that have been a part of our history for as long as we've been in North America.
That's fascinating. Now, talk about that, your research. You basically looked at two kelp forests, one in Southern California area, and then one up in the Northwest, and kind of did a study on that and compared and contrasted the two areas.
That's right. And I just have to say that these are two data sets that are 30 years old, which is just so unheard of in ecology, because you have to go out to these places every year, usually during the summer, with a whole field crew. These studies long predate me. And I'm just so grateful to the people who've worked tirelessly for years and years to, no matter what is going on, to go back out there and recollect data. When it was first pitched to me, it was the idea of bringing together these two different data sets that they're very similar the way they were collected, because one of the people, Jane Watson, who's also a co-author, she was a student of Jim Estes, also a co-author. Jim started a lot of the California work, and Jane, who was one of his students, got a job at the University of British Columbia and just sort of took those methods up more north along the coast. And so we have these two data sets that have been collected in a really similar way about the same kinds of ecosystems for a long time. And they pitched it to me as a compare and contrast, which for a scientist is, that's the holy grail, because no matter what happens, something interesting is going to come out of a compare and contrast. And yeah, what we found is that up north, there's much more of this kind of canonical keystone effect, where we would assume when sea otters are returned to the system, they eat up all the urchins enough to the point where they're sort of back into balance and allowing other species to grow. And it just flips the system back into a kelp forest. And off the coast of California, this happened, but it was much slower. And all the species sort of transitioned through this intermediate state that has persisted for a long time. And the question is really like, why do the keystone species in these systems, these sea otters, why do they behave differently in different places? Wouldn't they do the same thing everywhere? If they're so powerful and they engineer the entire system, then why are they behaving differently in one place versus another if the system is basically the same ecosystem? And part of what we were able to figure out is that it really matters what other species are doing in the system, not just the keystone species. The effect of the keystone species has to ripple out through the whole ecosystem. And these other species, they themselves might not be as important individually as sea otters, but they really sort of regulate how sea otters are able to have their effect. And so a lot of the species in the southern kelp forest by San Nick, they sort of slowed down this transition back to kelp forests and made the reintroduction of sea otters manifest in a different way. And I think that this just sort of is both fascinating and also helps us understand how to anticipate when we bring species back that once were in a place and then have been lost and we're trying to reintroduce them. How do we expect that they're, you know, that whole dynamic is going to play out?
Getting back to how important our kelp forests are, and then reintroducing these species has that ripple effect that helps the entire ecosystem find that healthier balance, that natural balance that has been disturbed. Also, these kelp forests are very important to all living life. Can you explain what they're doing with carbon and why they can be so important to us as a whole?
Yeah, well, you know, just like we humans, we take in oxygen and produce carbon dioxide when we exhale, and plants are the opposite. They take in carbon dioxide and exhale oxygen. Just as plants do that on the surface, these underwater forests are doing the same thing. We might think because we can't breathe underwater that this wouldn't be happening, but oxygen does dissolve into the water, and they absorb an incredible amount of carbon through photosynthesis, and also just sort of the growth of all of these underwater forests. That itself is also carbon that's manifesting underwater. And they absorb a lot of carbon, but they also play incredible roles along the coast in stabilizing those coastal communities. There's effects from all the species that live there that prevent things like erosion along the coast. Also just food sources like fish. A lot of the fish that we take out and then we enjoy ourselves are there because they're able to persist inside of these larger ecosystems. And in that way, this single species can have this rippling effect on all kinds of life, both human and other kinds of living things in and around the coast of California, British Columbia, all along. And one other thing to say is Kelp forests are all over the world. Some of the dominant kelp species are a little different, but they're found off the coast of South Africa, all around Australia. They're really all over the world. And so understanding what keeps them healthy here can help all kinds of systems, not just in North America, but everywhere around the world.
I read somewhere that their carbon that they sequester is 20 times more per acre than a land forest, which to me is staggering.
If I had to guess, I would say part of it is that there's such vertical height to these underwater forests that allows them to grow in size in ways that feel really different to people who are just used to wandering around in land and looking at sort of like a land forest. But I'd really encourage anyone listening to, if you don't know how to scuba dive, myself included, go online and just Google kelp forest and look at all these images. They're really inspiring to see these, what really look like forests underwater.
I think of coral reefs as a marine-based analogy, and they seem to get all the press, right? They're important. They provide physical and chemical and biological benefits to the marine environment and serve as a nursery. But so do kelp forests, as you allude to. They provide a physical, a chemical, and a biological, and eventually an ecological benefit to their local marine system.
This is absolutely right. And not to say that people shouldn't focus on coral reefs, which I think that like even just in there, they're just obviously so beautiful that it makes sense why people focus on them. And they do provide, as you're saying, lots of different benefits. But kelp forests in many ways they're like coral reefs in that they are home to so many different species. In some places, kelp forests have more species living in them than in other parts of coral reefs. So I think this is right that we should keep the press on coral reefs, but kelp forests deserve also to be thought of as these hotspots where there's just incredible amounts of biodiversity in very small places out in the water.
What about climate change? What is a warming world, or in this case, warming oceans, doing, or how are they possibly threatening kelp forest, the health and welfare of kelp forest, and possibly of the otters? I think maybe even the urchins too.
Interestingly, kelp forests are not found near the equator. There actually was some research that came out not that long ago that found there were some kelp forests that had formed deeper underwater where it was a little cooler, but the kelp actually don't like it when it gets really warm, which is why they're not by the equator. So one obvious effect of warming is that there is an upper limit where these kelp species just don't want to grow in really warm water. The paper itself focuses so much on the biological community. But one thing that we spent a lot of time on was thinking about abiotic variables. So abiotic are non-living things like what are the waves like off the coast? How big are the waves? What's the temperature of the water? What's the ENSO cycles? And an interesting thing that we found is that these non-living variables were not actually as important as the living species in our efforts to understand the effects of sea otters. Some of that may be sort of just that in this case, the system is not yet near its tipping point where it's just too warm. It could also be that sea otters are just such a powerful force that understanding what's going on in them right now is really more about protecting the living things there. I guess in a sort of transparent, honest way, this particular study didn't find a lot of evidence of that would be helpful in understanding how changes in the climate would affect these systems. But it's something that we intend to continue following up on, and also would imagine that maybe in other kelp forests around the world, temperature matters much more. Other things like as temperature changes, you get changes in salinity of the water, you get changes in the pH of the water, and maybe these other things are slowly building up and will reach some sort of a tipping point. We didn't see that in this particular study, but we know that kelp forests have a limit where they just can't survive if it gets too warm. So that's something that we hope as we continue to collect data that we can look for how these systems, now that they've reformed, how do they persist into the future amidst all this change?
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Ryan Langendorf, and he is professor at the University of Colorado. And we're talking about a paper he helped co-author, which is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And you can go online and see that. The title of the paper is Climate Change Scenarios in Fisheries and Aquatic Conservation Research. And it's kind of focuses on the study of sea otters in a couple locations, one in the Northwest and one in Southern California, and compares and contrasts those otter families, let's call them, populations in terms of their role as keystone species. So in the last few minutes that we have, Ryan, I believe you have a deep background in mathematics or so. And what role do you think that artificial intelligence might be able to play in helping you do research in a more a deeper way or more robust way? And because you talk about 30 years of data, that's a lot of data to go through. Does AI have a potential benefit in helping with ecological research?
This is such a great question. I think right now there's a big debate going on in ecology about how much can we collect data around the world on all kinds of living and non-living things and just feed it into a big AI and then have the AI help us figure out what should we do. And the reason we would, in theory, really love this is because the world is changing really quickly all around us. This is both man-made and non-man-made. There's just so much change in the world right now, and we need answers quickly. And the idea that we could take all the data we have so much data and just get answers from an AI is really, it's really tempting to want to believe this can help us solve our problems. I think right now we don't know. There are projects like NEON, for example, to just collect standardized data all over North America and see what we can do with that we are hoping will lead to some useful breakthroughs. But one of the big takeaways from this paper was that we tried to just feed a lot of data in and say, how can we understand kelp forests? How do we understand sea otter reintroductions? And it didn't work. The way that we were able to find useful answers is by talking to experts who have lived in these systems for decades, who helped put bumpers on the models to say some things we know are possible and some are not. And we can let the model run and figure things out inside of the constraints of our own human knowledge. And that actually is how we were able to finally get the model off the ground. And so I guess the answer is we don't know. We're hoping that maybe AI and these kinds of big data approaches will provide useful answers. And if they do, that's the goal. I just want to help these systems however we can get there. But at least right now, the answer is still we need humans and our own understanding of the world to help make these kinds of models useful.
And I would argue on that point that if we keep extracting ourselves further and further from the natural world and that attachment, then that ability to empathize and care starts to slide. So I feel like when you have human interaction that is deeply seated or deeply entrenched in caring about these kelp forests and caring about these ecosystems and caring about these sea otters, that you develop more of an empathy, which is something I don't think can be brought mechanically or by AI.
I think this is right. And also, like, I would add on top of empathy, which is so important, also intuition. As a mathematician trying to understand these systems, if you have no intuition for them, you don't even know where to begin. And this idea that just sort of a blank slate with a powerful enough model will solve our problems, maybe that's true, but we haven't found evidence of that yet. And I agree that part of that comes from that understanding of the systems. And also, I think that your point about empathy is really important. If we also don't empathize, we find no reason to care. We might say, like, oh, well, what does it matter if they all fall apart? Being in these systems, living with them, understanding them, admiring them, learning from them, realizing we don't understand everything about them is a really important part to getting us to a place where we can be useful and beneficial to these other living things.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that there's a lot of times in the natural world that we mimic some of the things that are happening there in our own world or in our own lives that work to help us as humans.
Completely agree. Yeah.
And I would, although I agree with what both of you are saying, I think AI could bring something to the table when it comes to trying to analyze the impacts from synergistic effects. That's always a complicated world to look at how, not just say, I'll use water quality as an example, not just to say like, well, lead in our water is bad for us. And we know we've done research on lead in drinking water, but we need to know a better sense of what lead plus PFAS plus some other volatile compounds in the water, what the synergistic effects are on, let's say, ecosystems. I think AI could perhaps help maybe, bring some better insight into that arena.
the synergistic effects, when you consider them, then the space of possible interactions grows exponentially, and it becomes really complex for us as humans to think about it. AI is one way to get into that complexity. I also think as we empathize, we also build blind spots where we care in a way that makes us want certain things to be true. And sometimes AI can also help just offer a perspective that is very non-human and help us see things that we had lost sight of while dealing with that tremendous complexity of all those synergistic effects. So my vision for the future is one that's collaborative between human and non-human kinds of models with the goal of trying to help these systems in whatever way we can.
Well, the study is super interesting and people can go online to check that out. Ryan, tell us where people can find this study and also more about what you're doing at the Doak Lab.
Yeah, so the study is, if you go to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which scientists just call PNAS, their website, if you search Kelp Forest Sea Otters, if you look up my name or Dan Doak's name, you'll find this paper. You have to wait 6 months until it becomes open access. Right now it's behind a paywall for just for 6 months. But if anyone wants to read this, I would love if they reached out to me, find my email on their website, and I will send you a PDF of it for you to read. And yeah, the Doak Lab it's a mix of all different kinds of ecologists who are interested in using quantitative computational mathematical models to understand the natural world. And we're really excited to take this research and try to move into other systems. We already are talking to people who work in Kenya, also other people off the coast of North America, just trying to apply this model in different ways to help other, you know, people who are stuck understanding other kinds of ecosystems. And I'm particularly excited in the idea of maybe focusing on species reintroductions, which is a big thing, not just in aquatic environments. In Colorado, for example, we just reintroduced gray wolves. And so using these kinds of models to understand how we can predict the effects of our own interventions is a big goal of mine.
That's fantastic. Ryan, we appreciate you so much for coming on This Green Earth and telling us a little bit more about that ecosystem and the importance of these kelp forests. And we hope to talk to you again in the future and learn more about what you're writing about and what you're studying there at the Doak Lab. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review, and we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.